So we're continuing our study through the Kings, and we're going through the kings of Judah, and we did Jehoram and Ahaziah, and we did a whole sermon on Queen Athaliah, which is really kind of this space holder, I guess, until Joash was going to become king. So we're going to get into Joash, the king of Judah, which is Ahaziah's son. Okay, so really the kingly line would be Jehoram, Ahaziah, Joash. And Athaliah is really not in that line, but she did reign for 6 years, and so I did a whole sermon on that. But Joash, or Jehoash, and you'll see that in the king of Israel, there's also a Joash or Jehoash. And so it's just a different way of saying the same name. You just see that it drops off the E-H in there. And it does that with Joshua. There's Jehoshua, and then there's Joshua, and then there's Jeshua, and kind of does the same thing with those names. But we see that he's 7 years old when he begins to reign. If you look back in chapter 11 and verse 21 there, it says 7 years old was Jehoash when he began to reign. And so that shows you that if it was in the seventh year of Jehu, and it was in the seventh year that they took out Athaliah, that he was a baby. I mean, he was a baby when all that stuff went down. And I already touched on that. So when Athaliah's story, you know, where she killed the seed royal, and I already touched on that. So I don't want to really get into that as far as what happened with Jehoiada and all that. We really just want to focus on what Joash did. Because obviously he was there, but it wasn't really his story as far as anything he had to do with it. He was just a baby when that happened, and he's 7 years old when they make him king. Now, in verse 1 here, it says, in the seventh year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign, and 40 years reigned he in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Zebiah of Beersheba. And Jehoash did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all his days, wherein Jehoiada the priest instructed him. But the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places. So we see here that he reigns for 40 years. So he reigns a good long time. But if you think about it, he's 47 years old when he dies. Okay, so he doesn't die at a ripe old age, because he started reigning at 7 years old. Okay, but the key here is that he did right in the sight of the Lord all the days when Jehoiada the priest instructed him. So it doesn't say that he did right in the sight of the Lord all of his days, but all the days that Jehoiada instructed him. And go to 2 Chronicles chapter 24, and I want you to keep your finger in 2 Kings chapter 12 and then 2 Chronicles 24, because these are parallel passages dealing with Joash, and we get some information on one that we don't have any other. And the way it words it in chapter 24 of 2 Chronicles, I believe it was just all the days that Jehoiada was alive, and I believe Jehoiada was instructing him, you know, all the days that he was alive. But this is a caveat, meaning that he's not going to do right inside the Lord once Jehoiada dies. That's what happens. And he's actually going to do something really wicked that even Jesus brings up in the New Testament. And so Joash is actually, it's interesting because you're going to read this, when we get to the story, you're going to be like, oh, that's what Jesus was talking about, you know, when he was ripping the Pharisee's face off, you know. And but in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse 1, it says, Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name also was Zebiah of Beersheba. And Joash did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. So in 2 Kings, it says all his days wherein Jehoiada the priest instructed him. So you can almost take that as far as like, well, while Jehoiada was instructing him, but really, it was till the death of Jehoiada. It was all the days of Jehoiada's life. And actually, what we're going to see is when you read 2 Chronicles 24, it's when Jehoiada dies that everything goes downhill. Okay, everything's kind of good, and it's working great until Jehoiada dies. And Joash is a king that I look at that he shouldn't be a king, meaning this, that Jehoiada was the leader and the one kind of instructing and saying, go do this. And as long as Joash had a good leader, had someone good to instruct him, he was fine. But as soon as he didn't have that, he went rogue. And there's a lot of people, and if there's anything to learn from Joash, is the fact that some people are just not meant to be leaders. They're not meant to be in that position where they have to make those hard calls, or they have to be in that position of authority. You know, it's where it comes into not everybody should be a pastor. Okay, it doesn't make them a bad person. It's just some people are not meant to be in that leadership position. They don't have the personality to handle certain situations and stuff like that. And some people just need to be followers, and they'll do great things for God doing that. And that's where I see with Joash is Joash is a guy that should not be in that position. But if he has someone to instruct him, he'll do great things in that position. But when he's left to his own, it's more of this, you know, if you didn't have anybody else, would you still do it? If you didn't have someone telling you to go do it, would you still do it? And this is where the church comes in. As far as soul winning, you know, God institutes the church to send out people to go soul winning. And honestly, it's probably just not going to happen if you don't have the church to do it, right? You're just going to burn out. You're not going to have the wherewithal to keep going. And you may go for a while. You may go for a couple years where you're just going out soul winning by yourself without a church, but it's not going to sustain. It's not sustainable to be that way. And there's some people that just, you know, need to be led. You know, it's just the way it is. And I view Joash as that kind of person. He just needs to be led. And Jehoiada is a great man to lead him here. But I do want you to see here, if you're in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, that Jehoiada is not perfect, okay? I'm going to show you something here that's clearly showing that he's not a perfect guy. But in verse 3 of 2 Chronicles 24, it says, "And Jehoiada took for him two wives, and he begat sons and daughters." So, all right, so he has multiple wives here. So this obviously isn't wise to do that. But the interesting thing about Jehoiada, I actually think that his wife, Jehoshabeth, or Jehoshabah, however you want to say it, she might actually not be alive at this point, okay? And the reason I say that is because Jehoiada is actually pretty old right here, okay? When Joash begins to reign, go to verse 15, because I'm going to show you that how old Jehoiada is when he dies. Now, mind you, Jehoiada dies before Joash is done reigning, okay? So Joash reigns for 40 years, okay? So he dies before Joash is done reigning, and he dies at the age of 130, okay? So in verse 15, it says, "But Jehoiada waxed old and was full of days when he died, and 130 years old was he when he died." That's a ripe old age right there. Good night. 130? Now, let's say that Jehoiada dies at the very last year of his reign. Let's say just everything just went the pot after, you know, Jehoiada dies, and it's just a year left. You know, I don't think it's necessarily that fast, but let's say it is. That means he was 90 years old when Joash began to reign. Okay? So, 90 years old, it's probably, what I think happened is his wife died, you know, that Jehoshabeth, the lady that saved, you know, the wife that saved Joash, I believe she probably died, and then he remarried and married like two wives, okay? And then he had sons and daughters with those new wives, okay? Because that would be a miracle in itself if his wife was having children at, you know, 90 or so, okay? If they were the same age when they were, you know, married and stuff like that. So, anyway, just things to think about here. But all that to say is that I don't believe Jehoiada was a perfect person here, because obviously he had two wives, and I don't believe it's right to have more than one wife. You're not supposed to multiply wives unto yourselves and stuff like that. It says that about kings, but I believe that applies to anybody. You know, especially, you know, you think of the qualifications of a bishop is to be the husband of one wife, and the qualification of a deacon is to be the husband of one wife. And so I don't believe that's just for those leaders. I think that's the way it should be. You know, a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves unto his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh, okay? I think it should be two that becomes one flesh, not three that becomes one flesh, okay? So all that to say is that he's 130 when he dies, so that means he's pretty old here. He's pretty old when Joash begins the reign. And, you know, I just wanted to kind of put that in there that Jehoiada, you know, is not perfect here. But I do think he's kind of the hero of the story. The hero of the story when it comes to taking out Athaliah. But also that he had such a good influence on Joash, you know, at a young age and obviously through his reign until Jehoiada dies, and then everything goes downhill after that. Now, Joash, during his reign, was minded, and the big thing that we see here, that he's trying to fix up the house of God, okay? So in chapter 24 there, in verse 4, and honestly, we're just going to be sticking in these two chapters pretty much, and just kind of talking about the story and just going through this. But it says in verse 4, it says, And it came to pass after this that Joash was minded to prepare the house of the Lord. And he gathered together the priests and the Levites and said unto them, Go out unto the cities of Judah and gather of Israel money to repair the house of your God from year to year, and see that ye hasten the matter. Howbeit, the Levites hastened it not. Now, going back to 2 Kings 12, verse 4, just to see that same thing that's going on here. 2 Kings 12 and verse 4, it says, And Joash said to the priests, All the money of the dedicated things that is brought into the house of the Lord, even the money of every one that passeth the account, that money that every man is set at, and all the money that cometh into any man's heart to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take it to them, every man of his acquaintance, and let them repair the breaches of the house wheresoever any breach shall be found. So he's basically saying, you know, go out and go get this money. You know, go collect this money. And this is something that's in the law of Moses, and, you know, basically that they're supposed to be giving to the Levites anyway, right? But they're supposed to be collecting this money. And you say, well, what are these breaches? Well, look at verse 7 of chapter 24. So 2 Chronicles chapter 24 and verse 7, it says, it gives the reason why there's breaches. It says in verse 7, For the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman, had broken up the house of God, and also all the dedicated things of the house of the Lord did they bestow upon Balaam. Okay? So this is the whole reason why he's fixing the house of God, is because Athaliah came in and destroyed it, or her sons did anyway. And they're, you know, basically, they gave all the dedicated things to Balaam. And Joash, you know, basically right here, what's interesting with chapter 12 of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles 24 is that there's two questions that are being asked. There's actually two things that are going on here. One is he's going to rebuke Jehoiada and the priest for not collecting the money. Okay? Because in 2 Chronicles 24, it says they hastened it not, right? Basically, they didn't do what they were told to do. And then he's going to say, you know, why haven't you repaired it? These are actually two different questions that I believe happen at two different times, okay? So this is why sometimes it's always good to look at the parallel passages, but when you're looking at 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, there's two separate questions that are being asked, and if you're not reading carefully, you can maybe take it as the same question and the same thing that's going on there. But actually, in one case, he's rebuking, if you look at 2 Chronicles 24, actually in 2 Chronicles 24, it's all about why didn't you collect the money, okay? He's not even talking about, you know, repairing the breaches yet. He's just saying, why didn't you collect the money? And so in verse 6, it says, And the king called for Jehoiada the chief and said unto him, Why hast thou not required the Levites to bring in out of Judah and out of Jerusalem the collection, according to the commandment of Moses, the servant of the Lord, and of the congregation of Israel for the tabernacle of witness? And it goes into, for the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman had broken up the house of God, and also all the dedicated things of the house of the Lord did they bestow upon Balaam. And so he's basically saying, you know, why didn't you get the money? And remember he said from year to year? So he says, do this from year to year. Basically, bring this money in from year to year. And he's coming to him and saying, why haven't you done this? So it's been years since he's given this commandment to go get the money. He's saying, you haven't done it. And so then he goes in and says, And at the king's commandment, they made a chest and set it without at the gate of the house of the Lord. And they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem and to bring in to the Lord the collection that Moses, the servant of God, laid upon Israel in the wilderness. And all the princes and all the people rejoiced and brought in and cast into the chest until they had made an end. Now it came to pass that at what time the chest was brought unto the king's office by the hand of the Levites, and when they saw that there was much money, the king's scribe and the high priest's officer came and emptied the chest and took it and carried it to his place again. Thus they did day by day and gathered money in abundance. Okay? Now this is where 2 Kings 12 picks up. Okay? So go to 2 Kings 12, verse 6. Because at this point, they got the money. Okay? And so he's rebuking them, why didn't you collect the money? And then they made a proclamation saying, hey, you need to all bring in money so we can fix the house of the Lord. And everybody's rejoicing, saying, yeah, let's do this. And they bring this money in. But then, this is where I believe this picks up. So they have the money, they're not doing anything with it, okay? They're not fixing the house of the Lord. Then in 2 Kings chapter 12, in verse 6, it says, "But it was so that in the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had not repaired the breaches of the house." Okay? So now we know that we're in the 23rd year of his reign. So we're more than halfway through that 40-year reign, and they still haven't prepared the breaches. So you can imagine that he gives out this proclamation and says, "Hey, I want to collect money to fix the house of the Lord." They don't do it. Years go by, and they don't even collect the money. Then he says, "Why haven't you collected the money?" And they send out a proclamation saying, "Day by day, bring in your money." So now it's kind of like a fast track, bring in your money instead of year by year. Then everybody's bringing in their money. And then he comes back. It's 23 years into his reign, and they still haven't prepared the breaches. And the reason I bring this up is because something that's said here is basically says, don't bring in any more money. Okay? And so that's why when you're reading this by itself, you're like, okay, what is this talking about? Because over here it says, bring in the money. Because if you look at this in order, now you can understand why he's saying, don't bring in the money, because you already have it. Don't ask for any more money. Don't bring in any more money. You already have the money. Just fix the house of the Lord, right? So in verse 7 there, it says, "Then King Jehoash called for Jehoiada the priest and the other priests and said unto them, why repair ye not the breaches of the house?" See, it's a different question. See, in 2 Chronicles 24, the question is, why did you not bring in the money for the collection? In 2 Kings chapter 12, it's, why did you not repair the house, right? So it's not asking about the money now, it's asking about the house. And then it says, "Now therefore receive no more money of your acquaintance, but deliver it for the breaches of the house." And it says, "And the priest consented to receive no more money of the people, neither to repair the breaches of the house." Now, you say, well, what does that mean? Meaning that they're not receiving any more money at all. He's basically saying, don't receive any more money for your acquaintance, but only for the house, for the breaches of the house. And they just didn't receive any more money because they have enough money. And that's what it's going to get into, is that they have more than enough money. So they're basically saying, don't bring any more money. We got enough. So in verse 9, it says, "But Jehoiada the priest took a chest and bore a hole in the lid of it, and set it beside the altar on the right side as one cometh into the house of the Lord. And the priest that kept the door put therein all the money that was brought into the house of the Lord. And it was so, when they saw that there was much money in the chest, that the king's scribe and the high priest came up and put up in bags and told the money that was found in the house of the Lord." Okay, so after all that's done, right, to get these breaches fixed, they just did not want to move on this, right? So Joash is, so you kind of see the story, right? Joash is saying, go collect money so that we can fix the house of the Lord. And they don't do it. Then he comes back and says, Jehoiada and all these priests, what are you doing? You're supposed to do this. Then they go and collect the money and just kind of set it there and don't do anything with it, right? So now they have the money. They're saying, why haven't you, you know, repaired the breaches of the house of the Lord? And I kind of think of this, you know, there's obviously a spiritual realm you can think of this on the laziness to fix the things in the house of God. And what we're going to see here is that it's very clear that they fixed the house of God before they fixed the vessels in it. Okay, all the shiny, nice things that are inside of it. They fixed the breaches, the holes. And the things that are inside are the things that are kind of the decorations and the things that are look nice and all that stuff. But really, you need to worry about the building itself. Okay, it's kind of like when you're dealing with the structure compared to all the stuff that's on the outside of the structure, right? What's more important? Now, I'm a structural engineer, so of course I'm going to say that's more important. But in all reality, isn't that more important that the building stands up than whether it looks beautiful or not? Wouldn't you rather have a building that wasn't going to fall over top of you, but it looks like just, you know, OSB, you know, like siding on it, and it just like looks kind of trashy, but it's strong, and it does its job, then a building that looks really beautiful inside, but it's about to fall in on you, okay? I'm going to take the strong building over the beautiful one any day of the week, okay? And so what they do is they take the money and they put it towards the breaches of the house before they take care of the vessels. Because if you remember, Athaliah, you know, they broke down the house of the Lord. They put breaches in it. But they also took all the vessels and gave it unto Balaam. Okay, so all the vessels, all the silver and gold vessels and all that stuff were taken out. And so, but notice that they take care of the structure first. And when it comes to the house of God, and when it comes to the pillar and ground of the truth, you need to be working on the structure before you start working on all the frivolous things on the outside. When you think of the doctrines of a church, you think about the fact that we're salvation by faith alone in Jesus Christ, eternal security. We believe the King James Bible is perfect without error, and that you do not need to go back to the Greek or Hebrew, but you have a perfect Bible in English that you can read it, study it, and that's all you need, okay? That we go soul winning, that we're independent. You know, those foundational things, that needs to be shored up. And if you have a breach in that, you need to be worrying about that before you get to end times prophecy. You need to be worrying about that before you get to Zionism or before you get to other things in the Bible. And listen, all those things are important, right? Would anyone say that the vessels of the house of the Lord aren't important? They're used for a job, so they're obviously important. But the structure of the building is most important. And it's crucial. It's live or die. Does that make sense? Like the building, the structure of the building, if there's a fault in it, people die. If the door doesn't open and shut properly, yeah, no one, you don't like that, right? But no one dies from that usually, right? Or if there's like, you know, the window's out of sync, or it doesn't look beautiful, it's not clean, or, you know, different things like that. You know, the tile's missing from the ceiling, right? Who cares? I mean, you care, right? You care about the way things look. But what I'm saying is that's not going to be crucial to your life. It's not life or death, okay? And so when it comes to the house of God, you know, spiritually speaking, you need to take care of the structure first. This is why a lot of people struggle with end times prophecy, because they don't have their structure down, first of all, before they start filling in everything else. You know, if you just looked at the Bible and looked at, you know, here's the structure. Tribulation, rapture, wrath, boom, everything else falls into place. But if you don't have that structure and you start jumping in there without the structure, then you're going to be all over the place. Get that structure down, start filling in everything else, and it'll all fit together, it'll all look beautiful, and all that stuff works out. So you can take this in many avenues. You can take it in the church as a whole, as far as the doctrines you stand on. You can take it into each doctrine. Each doctrine should be a structure that's sound, that's not going to fall apart, that's founded upon a rock, and then you build upon that and fill in all the different things that go in with that. Okay? And notice in verse 11, so you're in 2 Kings chapter 12. 2 Kings chapter 12 and verse 11 there. It says in verse 11, it says, "And they gave the money being told into the hands of them that did the work and had the oversight of the house of the Lord, and they laid it out to the carpenters and builders that wrought upon the house of the Lord, and to masons and hewers of stone, and to buy timber and hewed stone for to repair the breaches of the house of the Lord, and for all that was laid out of the house, out for the house to repair it." Okay, so obviously, what are you dealing with? You're dealing with masons, you're dealing with stone, you're dealing with, this is the structure of the building, right? We're dealing with the fact that this building's probably structurally unstable at this point because of what they've done to it. And so they're dealing with those things first. Now notice in verse 13, "Howbeit, there were not made for the house of the Lord bowls of silver, snuffers, basins, trumpets, any vessels of gold or vessels of silver of the money that was brought into the house of the Lord. But they gave that to the workmen and repaired therewith the house of the Lord. Moreover, they reckoned not with the men into whose hand they delivered the money to be bestowed on the workmen, for they dealt faithfully." And that last verse is basically just saying that, you know, they were working on trust as far as the payment went, you know. They weren't overseeing, like they didn't have like a financial like advisor here on like how everybody got paid. They basically just dealt faithfully with it, you know, as far as, are you really doing the work? Are you really doing what you should be doing? Are you putting in the time? Are you working for the time that you're doing? They just dealt faithfully with the money and the work. So that it's just kind of putting it into that hand. So it wasn't real this cutthroat where people are watching you and hawking over your work and all that stuff. But notice that it says that they did not use that money for that. Now, the thing is that they eventually do make the vessels, though. Okay, go to 2 Chronicles chapter 24. So in that passage, it almost sounds like they didn't make the vessels at all. They just repaired the breaches. But they actually did. But the key is that they fixed the house first. Okay, they got their house in order first. They got the building in order first. They got the structure done first before they started messing with all the things inside of it. And verse 13 there. So in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse 13, it says, "So the workmen wrought, and the work was perfected by them, and they set the house of God in his state and strengthened it. And when they had finished it, they brought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada, whereof were made vessels of the house of the Lord, even vessels to minister and offer withal, and spoons and vessels of gold and silver. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of the Lord continually all the days of Jehoiada." So they eventually did take care of everything else. And you can kind of think of this, you know, where it says make first clean the inside of the platter and then that the outside may be clean also. It's kind of the same thing, you know, you think about working on the inside first and then working on the outside after that. It's not that the outside is not important, it's just that what's more important, the inside. And the same thing with the house of God, the structure is more important than all the pretty things that are inside of it, you know. And when it comes to church and our church, we should always remember that the structure needs to stay sound. And never let some pet doctrine be, you know, taking the forefront of anything else, right? You say, well, you know, you believe post-trib rapture. Yeah, but, you know, the King James Bible being perfect and salvation by grace through faith alone and our church going soul winning is more important than that. You're like, oh, I can't believe it. Yes, it is. It is more important than that. And listen, I believe the post-tribulation rapture, and I preach that. I did a whole series on that stuff. But that's not going to be the only thing that we're, you know, oh, well, that Mountain Baptist church down there, that's all they talk about is the post-tribulation rapture. No, it should be that we're talking about salvation by grace through faith, that we're talking about soul winning, that we're talking about the King James Bible, that we're talking about the foundational truth, the gospel of Jesus Christ being preached throughout all the world. That should be our mission. That should be the structure. And yes, all that stuff, guess what? We'll bring on all those vessels too. After we get all that together, okay? And so never sacrifice the structure for beauty, okay? As a structural engineer, yeah, no. Because there's many times that architects will want something to look a certain way, and I just have to say, no, it can't be done structurally. And hopefully they listen to that, right? Now, I mean, if I'm on the job, obviously they're going to have to listen to that because I'm not going to sign off on something that's not structurally sound. And so there's a lot of things that look beautiful, but they can't be done structurally to where it's safe or that it's structurally sound. And so those are the types of things you got to be thinking about is like, yeah, that looks cool. You know, upside down pyramids look cool, but it's not practical structurally, right? You know, putting something out, you know, like cantilevers that are 30 feet long, that looks cool. But, you know, unless you want to defy gravity and you invent skyhooks or you want a hot air balloon holding that thing up out there, you know, it's just not going to work very well. And so that's what I kind of think of. And you're like, you always bring up engineering. Sorry, it's my job. You know, I think about those type of things. But I do think about the fact that what is priority? There are priorities in the house of God. There's priorities on doctrines. There's priorities on things that I preach more than others, okay, because they're more important, okay? So, but going on from that, Jehoiada dies. And so we see in verse 15 there. So we're going to stick in 2 Chronicles 24 here pretty much for a while so you can kind of keep your finger there. But Jehoiada dies. And notice what it says in verse 15. It says, "But Jehoiada waxed old and was full of days. And when he died, and 130 years old was he when he died, and they buried him in the city of David among the kings, because he had done good in Israel, both toward God and toward his house." Now, this is a pretty big deal here. I mean, he's buried with the kings. And he's a priest. So, obviously, he's of the tribe of Levi to be the priest there. And so, it's very interesting here. And it says that he's 130 years old. Now, this debunks a theory out there, the fact that people are only going to live to 120. Okay? Now, they get this. And this is just a side note. This has nothing. This isn't in my notes. I'm just thinking about it. But in Genesis chapter 6, it talks about how God says that his spirit will not always strive with man, and for his days shall be 120. Or his years shall be 120, right? Not days. But Or maybe it says days shall be 120 years. I don't have it in my notes, but it says 120 years, right? So they use that to say, well, after the flood, that means everybody's only going to live up to 120 years old. Well, we know that doesn't happen immediately anyway. But the thinking is that, you know, once everything kind of settles down, basically only people are going to live up to 120. But Jehoiada proves that wrong right here. Okay. Now, you say, well, what is that talking about? I believe it's talking about from when he says that, 120 years until the flood happens. Okay. That's what I believe he's talking about. We know that it's 100 years from when he told Noah to build the ark, because Noah was 500 years old when he was told to build the ark, and he was 600 when the flood came. Okay. So that means that God stated that 20 years before he told Noah to build the ark. Okay. And that's my belief on that. And here's the thing. Then I don't have to justify this, right? You know, there's no, like, cap on how old people can live. But I'll say this. Once you get past 130, it's probably not going to be that much further than that, okay? So people live a little longer here, even way after the flood. Jehoiada's living to 130, okay? This is before modern medicine and, you know, well, who knows what they had back then necessarily. But I don't think they were doing open-heart surgery back then, you know, on Jehoiada here. But all that to say is that, you know, 130, I don't believe that contradicts anything in the Bible. And people may get heartburn because they see that and be like, oh, there must be a mistake in that. No, your mistake is what you're interpreting Genesis 6 as, in my opinion, okay? So I don't believe there is a cap on that. So if someone says, hey, you know, and you'll see this, right, where there'll be a news story where someone lives to 135 or something like that, or 125. And most of the time, these people that are living that long are out in some, like, third world country, and they don't even know when they were born, okay? So take that with a grain of salt anyway when someone says, oh, he's 180. Okay. But anyway, if they were 180, I don't see where the Bible says they can't be, but I think it's highly unlikely at this point that it's going to go that high to where they're actually going to be able to even move around or breathe on their own. But anyway, I just wanted to kind of throw that out there, that I believe he's 130. I don't think there's anything that contradicts that in Scripture, that he was 130. But Judah goes downhill after Jehoiada dies. And notice what it says in verse 17. It says, now after the death of Jehoiada came the princes of Judah and made obeisance to the king. Then the king hearkened unto them. And this is really where I see Jehoiada being a companion of fools. You know, like having a companion of fools. Meaning that he has a bunch of fools, these princes that come to him. And he just hearkens unto him. And Jehoiada's gone now, so Jehoiada's not there to keep him in his place. And I believe these princes knew that. I believe these princes, you know, it doesn't say they're children of Belial, but I'll give you a reasoning why I may think they're children of Belial, or that at least some of them are. But I think they're just waiting. They were just waiting for that rock to be moved, right? That steady helm of Jehoiada to be out of the way for them to just strike. And they're just waiting to take the reins of Joash. And notice what it says in verse 18. And they left the house of the Lord God of their fathers and served groves and idols. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this their trespass. Yet he sent prophets to them to bring them again unto the Lord. And they testified against them, but they would not give ear. Now, this is why I believe that Jehoiada didn't die like the year before the end of his reign, okay? Because I don't think it was like 1 year where he's just sending all these prophets. I think it's probably years of him sending these prophets to where they're hearing that, hey, you're messing up. What are you doing? And, you know, they're not hearing it, okay? And this is where Zechariah is murdered, okay? This is the story that Jesus brings up in Matthew 23, okay? So in 2 Chronicles chapter 24 and verse 20, so notice that he'd already sent prophets, okay? He sent prophets to him, and they would not hear him. And then Zechariah is going to stand up. And I believe this is Zacharias, the son of Berechias, okay? So in verse 20 there, it says, and the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest, which stood above the people, and said unto them, thus saith God, why transgress ye the commandments of the Lord that ye cannot prosper, because ye have forsaken the Lord, he hath also forsaken you. So he preaches a hard sermon against them and says, you've forsaken the Lord, he's also forsaken you. And you're trespassing against the commandments of the Lord. Notice in verse 21, And they conspired against him and stoned him with stones at the commandment of the king in the court of the house of the Lord. So notice that where they did this at. Where did they stone him? Where did they kill him? In the court of the house of the Lord. What's in the court? The altar. So you have the tabernacle, you have the first tabernacle, which is, you know, where the priest can go in. So the building is basically the first tabernacle, second tabernacle. But on the outside is the court, but out there is where you have the altar, where they do the burnt offerings and everything. And I'm not going to, for sake of time, I'm not taking you into Exodus to show you this. But then it says, thus Joash the king remembered not the kindness which Jehoiada his father had done to him, but slew his son. And when he died, he said, the Lord look upon it and require it. So this is Zechariah saying, the Lord look upon it and require it. It's kind of a little different than Stephen, right? Stephen says, you know, let not the sin be upon them or be to their charge. And Zechariah is saying, let the Lord look upon it and require it. Very interesting, because notice what Jesus says about this man here in Matthew chapter 23. Because I'm going to show you that Jesus is saying that his blood is going to be required. And Jesus didn't forget this. And I believe this is the Zechariah that Jesus is talking about, not the Zechariah that wrote the book of Zechariah. Because Zechariah the prophet, in the minor prophets, he's coming in after like the Babylonian, you know, after they come out of captivity and they're building the house of the Lord. That's where Zechariah, the son of Iddo, you know, of Iddo, is at. And it does say Berechias. That's why it can get confusing. And you're in Matthew 23. I'm just going to read Zechariah 1, you know, like the intro to Zechariah there. Because this is where it can get confusing. You're like, is this the Zechariah? Is this the same one? But I don't believe it is. And you can kind of think of that because if Jesus is bringing him up as like from Abel to Zacharias, you're like, okay, is that the same one? Because the Zechariah that wrote the book of Zechariah, it says, in the eighth month in the second year of Darius came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying. So even his dad's name is Berechiah, right? And so I don't believe that's the same person, though, okay? I believe that this, because, first of all, it never says that Zechariah is ever murdered or killed, you know, that Zechariah anyway. But in verse 34 of Matthew 23, Matthew 23 and verse 34, it says, wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them ye shall kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechias, whom ye slew between the altar, or between the temple and the altar. Now, where was Zechariah killed in this story? In the court, which would be between the temple and the altar, okay? And so this is the last person you see him being martyred, actually, in the Old Testament. So that's why I believe he's the last one that Jesus mentions. I don't believe he's the only person that's being killed, okay? So don't get that mixed up, you know, that people are obviously, you know, killed for the cause of God and Christ, you know, after this guy's killed. But I believe he's the last one mentioned in the Old Testament as someone that's being martyred, for the cause of Christ, for preaching right and everything. So he brings up Abel, which obviously that goes all the way back to Genesis, right? The very beginning of Genesis. Abel was killed by Cain, his brother, because his works were righteous and his brother's evil, you know? Or his works were evil and his brother's righteous. And then Zechariah is the son of Berechias. Now you say, well, you know, it says he's the son of Berechias, not the son of Jehoiada. Well, Jehoiada is 130 years old when he dies, okay? It's very what I believe is that Jehoiada is his grandfather. Okay, so it's basically Zechariah, the son of Berechias, the son of Jehoiada. Okay, which makes a lot of sense, though, right? Because I mean, he's 90 years old when Joash even begins the reign. Okay, so he could have obviously had grandchildren that are preaching at this point when he's 130. This is past that too, right? So we're talking like Jehoiada would have been over 130 years old at this point. For him to have grandchildren is not out of the ordinary. Okay. So, but I think it's bringing up the point, why it brings up Jehoiada and not Berechias, is because Jehoiada is the priest that saved Joash, And isn't that what it says, that he did not, that Joash, the king, remembered not the kindness which Jehoiada, his father, had done to him, but slew his son. So I believe why he's bringing up he's the son of Jehoiada and not bringing up his dad, Berechias, is because Jehoiada is the one that saved him. And he killed his son, right? Which I believe would be his grandson, okay? And so this is a very evil thing. And notice that it's not just the princes. It was at the commandment of the king. The king gave the commandment to stone Zechariah. That's huge. That's crazy to think about, right? To kill the son of the person that saved your life when you were a child. And it's just kind of crazy to think about the fact that that's how far down he went. But this is where it really begins, because now Joash is going to be killed by his own people. Okay, there's going to be a conspiracy. It's almost like we're reading the book of the kings of Israel, where there's conspiracies and someone takes him out. But that's what happens, is that Joash is going to reap what he's sown. And God sends Syria against him. Okay, so at this point, when he was following Jehoiada's orders and he was, you know, basically under his instruction, he was doing great. He was repairing the house of God. They were doing sacrifices unto the Lord. You know, they were coming back to God. And so he kind of, remember, you saw how you had Abijah that did pretty well, wasn't perfect. But then you had Asa, who was a great king. And then Jehoshaphat even did better. But then they had that downturn, right, when they made affinity with the house of Ahab. And you had Jehoram and Ahaziah. And that didn't work out well. But then they all died. Remember, Jehoram's the one that had the disease in his bowels and died that horrible death. Ahaziah died in battle. Jehu and his men is the one that killed him. But then Joash is promising, right? It's this child that's being brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, so to speak. But as soon as Jehoiada dies, it just goes downhill. And so going into 2 Chronicles chapter 24, in verse 23, I believe this happens at the end of this year. So basically, at this point, this is pretty much the end of his reign. You know, he has Zechariah killed, and Zechariah is saying, "The Lord require this." And I believe the Lord Jesus brought it up. You know, when he's condemning Jerusalem, because who killed him? Jerusalem killed Zechariah. And you say, well, you know, how can he put that blood on them? Because he's talking about the children of Belial, that's why. Because Cain was of that wicked one and slew Abel, his brother. He was of the children of Belial. And guess what? He just got done telling the Pharisees that you're of your child the devil, and that they make him twofold more the child of hell themselves when they make these proselytes, their wicked, corrupt fruit that they have. And so he's ripping their face off. And I believe a bunch of reprobates killed Zechariah. So he's going to require all this righteous blood on their hands, because he's talking about the family of the devil. That's what he's talking about. And that Jerusalem's filled with that. Their leaders are filled with that. And it was all going to be coming down on them. And he's going to require it of that generation. He's basically all this bloodshed from Abel to Zechariah, he's going to put on them. And obviously Joash is going to reap what he's sown here. And in verse 23... which, you know, it could be a testament that he was actually saved, that he's basically just taken out by God, right? Because if he wasn't saved, you could see it being like, you know, like one of these wicked kings where they just keep going on and they're doing wicked things. But this happens and it's done for Joash. He's done, okay? In verse 23, it says, "And it came to pass at the end of the year that the host of Syria came up against him, and they came to Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the princes of the people from among the people and sent all the spoil of them unto the king of Damascus. For the army of the Syrians came with a small company of men, and the Lord delivered a very great host into their hand, because they had forsaken the Lord God of their fathers, so they executed judgment against Joash." So what happened here? Syria came up with a small company of men, and they took out, they were delivered, you know, into this great host of Israel, you know, the great host of Judah. So Judah had a bigger army. And God, you know, let Syria take him out. And notice that he destroyed all the princes of the people, destroyed all the princes of the people from among the people. So all those princes of Judah that brought, Joash into this mess to begin with, and that we're probably coaxing him to kill Zechariah anyway, God takes him out. So all those princes are taken out, and Joash is going to be taken out eventually. But when this happens, this is why, again, it's good to look at these two parallel passages, because you don't see this mentioned in 2 Kings, where they came in and destroyed all the princes and all this happened. All you see in 2 Kings is that Hazael, king of Syria, go to 2 Kings chapter 12, and I'll show you this, because it's interesting how it doesn't mention all that went down. But basically what happens, they come in, they destroy all the princes of Judah, and then Joash just gives them a whole bunch of stuff. He's basically trying to pay them off to get out of there, right? And so in verse 17, it says, "Then Hazael, king of Syria, went up and fought against Gath and took it, and Hazael sent his face to go up to Jerusalem." Now, that's all it really mentions about what they did at Jerusalem. So that's where 2 Chronicles comes in and basically states that they came in and that they destroyed all the princes of the people. And it says they took the spoil to the king of Damascus, but this is where the spoil is coming from too. Because notice in verse 18 of chapter 12, it says, "And Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the hallowed things that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, his fathers, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own hallowed things, and all the gold that was found in the treasures of the house of the Lord and in the king's house, and sent it to Hazael, king of Syria, and he went away from Jerusalem." So that's how he got rid of them, right? So they come in and destroy their princes, and they're reaping what they've sown, obviously. And God delivered them into the king of Syria, even with a small host. I mean, he just had a small group of men. But that's what happens when you go against the Lord. That's what happens when you fight against the Lord. You know, in some cases, if you have less and they have more, listen, if you're on God's side, he can deliver you and deliver you into that victory right there. But if you're against the Lord and you're against the commandments of God, it doesn't matter how many people you have. It doesn't matter how big your army is. God can take it out. See, the reverse can come back on you when you're disobeying God. And so, yeah, so what really happens is that, you know, even Joash has to basically take all these hallowed things that his fathers had dedicated unto the Lord, which he dedicated unto the Lord, and the gold that was in the treasures of the house of the Lord. He had to take all that and give it to the king of Syria to get him off his back. And so, but now you kind of see the whole picture, that people were actually killed. It wasn't just that they came in. See, if you're reading 2 Kings, you would just think, well, they just came in and he basically just paid them off and they left. No, they came in and killed people. They came in and destroyed the princes of Judah, and rightfully so, honestly, because they were wicked and they're the ones that coaxed Joash into forsaking the Lord and going after idols and all this other, you know, stupid garbage that they shouldn't have been doing. But in 2 Chronicles 24, we see the end of Joash here. So you can kind of see, you read through and you're looking at King Joash, you're like, ah, you know, he seems like a good guy. He's like, why aren't you collecting the money to fix the house of the Lord? And why aren't you fixing the house of the Lord? And they fix the house of the Lord. They start doing sacrifices and they're doing all this stuff. And you're like, man, good. Until Jehoiada dies. But what you really see is that Jehoiada is the rock in this whole story here. Jehoiada is the one that's... Remember when they saved, when they made Joash king, and he basically told them all, you need to make oaths that you're going to serve God and you're going to keep his commandments. And he's basically trying to get the people to follow the Lord. That was Jehoiada. Then Joash comes in, and guess what? Joash is a good king while Jehoiada's there. So Jehoiada's really the hero of the story here. And King Joash should have just been, he shouldn't have been in that place of authority because he couldn't handle it. Because as soon as Jehoiada was gone, he couldn't handle it. And all the wicked princes of Judah jumped in and took advantage. Now in verse 25 there, so 2 Chronicles 24 and verse 25, it says, "And when they were departed from him, for they left him in great diseases." So, I mean, the Assyrians left them in a bad state, right? I mean, they spoiled them. They left them in diseases. I mean, just who knows what all went down during this period of them being spoiled and everything that's going on. So Joash is definitely not popular. It says, "His own servants conspired against him for the blood of the sons of Jehoiada, the priest and slew him on his bed. And he died, and they buried him in the city of David, but they buried him not in the sepulchres of the kings. That's interesting. It says sons, plural. Did he kill more than just Zechariah? I mean, I'm just kind of just talking about it here because it doesn't mention anybody else, but it says sons, plural. It says for the blood of the sons of Jehoiada the priest. So it sounds like it wasn't just Zechariah that got taken out here. And so that speaks a lot, but they take him out for that. They take him out for the reason of taking out Zechariah and Jehoiada's sons there. And the thing that's interesting here is that he was buried in the city of David, but he was not buried in the sepulchres of the kings. But guess who was? Jehoiada. Remember when we were reading when he died that he was buried among the kings? So Jehoiada was buried with the kings, but not Joash. So if you remember, Jehoram was buried not being desired, right? But Joash was buried not with the kings. But he was in the city of David, right? He was in Jerusalem or Bethlehem, you know, that area which would be the city of David. So it's just interesting that Jehoiada was, but not Joash. In verse 26 here, it says, "And these are they that conspired against him, Zabad, the son of Jimeath, and Ammonitis, and Jehoshabad, the son of Zimrith, a Moabitess." So taken out by an Ammonite and a Moabite, right? Now concerning his sons, and the greatness of the burdens laid upon him, and the repairing house of the Lord, behold, they are written in the story of the book of the kings, and Amaziah his son reigned in his stead. So it does kind of end on a high note there, because it's talking about how he repaired the house of the Lord and the burdens that were laid upon him and all this stuff. So it's interesting on how that how it kind of ends there on kind of a high note for him. But it does mention that he was not buried with the kings. And, you know, it goes into Ecclesiastes, you know, the day of one's death is greater than the day of one's birth, you know. And we should be thinking about how we end our life more than how we began it, right? Because you forget about those things which are past and reach forth unto those things which are before and press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. You know, if you had a bad past or you messed up, you know, forget about that and move on. But you don't want to end on that doing bad. You know, you want to end on the high note. You want to end on doing right and doing what you should for the Lord. And every time I read these kings, I'm always just like, man, why couldn't you just do right till the end? You know? But it's a testament that a lot of people don't. Okay? And so we need to keep that in mind. You need to be cognizant of that and the fact of, hey, you know what? I'm doing right now, but let me not just lean on that. I need to be doing right till the day I die. You know, being faithful unto death is not necessarily just being a martyr for Christ, you know, or being killed for the cause of Christ. You know, being faithful unto death should be something that we're thinking about as far as just living faithful to the end. And Joash is one that didn't, but it is an example of someone that can do great things if they're led in the right direction, okay? And this is an example, like I said, of someone that shouldn't be a leader, okay? Now, we're all leaders in our own right, right? We all have leadership when it comes to our families and stuff like that. So I'm not saying like you shouldn't be a leader at all in anything. But what I'm saying is that certain positions of leadership, certain positions of power, certain people shouldn't be in that position, okay? And, you know, I'm not going to like start naming people that shouldn't be in a position of power. But what I'm saying is that there are certain people that I've looked at and be like, that person should never be a pastor. Just because I know they're unstable. Just because I know that on their own, they probably wouldn't stay the course, okay? And it's nothing against the person and the people that have thought that about it. It's not like I'm looking at them like, oh, you're a horrible Christian or anything like that. It's just that that's the fact. And they'll do great things for God as long as they're put it, you know, kind of pointed in the right direction. But it's also a testament, you know, to the people that are leaders. You know, I think about myself, that I need to be staying the course and not get comfortable and not think, well, you know, I've done right here and here and here. You know, no, I need to continue to do right. I need to continue to be pressing toward that mark and not think, well, I've done this in the past. Well, I'm not going to look in the past. I'm going to keep looking on the future and keep doing right. And my goal is to keep doing this till the day I die. That's my goal. You know, it may not be a lofty goal, but it's a goal of just basically just still doing what I'm doing until I die. And I believe that should be the goal of every Christian, is to be faithful unto death and to just keep doing what you're doing and not fall out and just keep going on and not be one of these kings that did great things for God, but then just the end of their life was horrible. You know, I don't want that to be the end for any of us. So let's end with a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, we thank you for today. Thank you for the souls that were saved. And thank you for your word. Thank you for these passages, Lord, that we can learn from. And, Lord, that we can use. And, Lord, we just pray that you be with us throughout this week. I pray that you be with those that aren't feeling well. And, Lord, that you would heal the sick and be with us with our jobs. Help us to get everything we need to get done. And I pray that everything that we do would be glorifying to you. In Jesus Christ's name, amen.